Man walked away from God. And when man walked away from God because of sin, Romans 6:23 reminds us that God had to remove man's right to live. The wages of sin is death. James said in James 1:15 that sin, when it is full grown, bringeth forth death. Now man needs his right to live back. And the rest of the Bible is God's scheme of redemption, or the story of God restoring man's right to live through His plan of salvation. In this study, we have defined atonement. We have looked at sin, the necessity of atonement. And we have observed sacrifice, the avenue of atonement. Today, I want us to bring our study to a conclusion by looking at salvation, the accomplishment of atonement. You see, if it doesn't come out here, it's been useless. If we're not saved, then it really doesn't matter how many animals died. It really does not matter how man has lived. Sin really doesn't matter if salvation is not the accomplishment of atonement. Now, we noted on Monday that everything is looking toward Jesus. Beginning in Genesis 3 and verse 15, I'm put enmity between thee and the woman, between thy seed and her seed. He shall bruise thy head, thou shalt bruise his heel. Beginning there, everything is looking toward the coming of Jesus. And we talk about the seed promise as it is developed through the Bible. The coming one, the Messiah, the Mashiach, the anointed, is going to come. And He's going to come in order to bring God and man back together through the accomplishment of salvation. I believe the book of Hebrews makes this abundantly clear in 13 stanzas, if you please, through the chapters of that marvelous book. And you've been looking at the types and shadows. Many of our speakers have made reference to Hebrews. And I, too, do not believe that you are ready to study the book of Hebrews until you understand the Old Testament. And it's amazing to me how we do things in our literature. And I don't want to get on my soapbox, but just a little bit. Since I'm speaking, I can get up and down as I want to on my soapbox. But it's amazing to me that one quarter we study Genesis, the next quarter we study Colossians, the next quarter we study Exodus, the next quarter we study 1 Thessalonians, the next quarter we study Leviticus, the next quarter we might study Matthew, and we expect folks to know something. You cannot see the unfolding of the plan of God in that kind of a hopscotch method. We need to show people the beautiful picture that God has laid out so that when we get to Hebrews, they have a background upon which to build, and that is the Old Testament. I usually, when I'm in local work, on Sunday nights, preach expository sermons. And I always begin the first Sunday night I'm there with an introduction to Genesis. And as long as the Lord lets me stay, then we just start Genesis. We go Genesis 1, Genesis 2, Genesis 3. And you know me, I don't always cover a chapter a night, but I try to. And then we finish Genesis, we go to Exodus, and we just go right on through till the Lord transfers me. And then when He transfers me, we start over an introduction to Genesis. And it almost never fails that after I've gone about to Genesis chapter 2, some well-meaning brother will come out and say, you know, I really appreciate your sermons, but I'll really be glad when we get into the New Testament. You know that's the covenant under which we live. And I say, yes, and go on about the business. And we get to Genesis 3 and Genesis 4 and Genesis 5 and Genesis 6. And after a while, this same fellow will come out and say, man, I didn't realize you needed to know all this to understand the New Testament. And I'll say, well, you do know we live under the New Testament, don't you? And he'll say, yes, I know that. And what am I saying here? I'm saying that what I did on Monday and what I did on Tuesday is necessary for me to do what I'm going to do today, or you won't have a clue as to what the Hebrews writer even had in mind. Jesus made purification of sins, Hebrews chapter 1 and verse 3. In Titus chapter 2 and verse 14, Paul said that Jesus gave Himself for us that there carries with it the idea of in order that He might redeem us from all iniquity and purify unto Himself a people for His own possession, zealous of good works. He might do what? Redeem. That's the word we introduced Monday. In this idea of ransom, in this idea of substitution, in this idea of salvation based on covering, expiation, atonement. And so we see the covering of sin ultimately based on what Jesus did. In Hebrews chapter 2, verses 9 and 10, we learn that Jesus tasted of death for every man. Now notice this, as the author of their salvation. In Hebrews chapter 2 and verse 17, we learn that in doing this, in tasting of death for every man, he became a merciful and faithful high priest in things pertaining to God to make propitiation for the sins of the people. Now, we didn't talk about propitiation Monday by name. But you see, you don't talk about ransom, and you don't talk about expiation, and you don't talk about substitution, and you don't talk about redemption without talking about propitiation. And Roger's simple definition of propitiation is Jesus died in my stead. He died in my place. And in my judgment, the best illustration of propitiation is Genesis 22. When Isaac is lying on that altar and that knife is pulled back, had there been an angel standing by the presence of God, he would have said, "That old man's going to kill that boy." And God said, "Stay thy hand." And I love the terminology here. There's a ram over here. And you take that ram and you offer him, now here it is, instead of. That's ransom. That's propitiation. That's substitution. And Jesus became our high priest as the author of our salvation to make propitiation for the sins of the people. In Hebrews chapter 3 and verse 1, he is the apostle and high priest of our confession. Now, an apostle is one sent. A high priest is one who offers in the behalf of the people. So Jesus is the one sent from God to offer up the covering for sins. And in order to enjoy this cleansing, in Hebrews 3, verse 6 and verse 14, we must hold fast the boldness and glorying of our hope firm unto the end, lest haply there shall be in any one of you an evil heart of unbelief in falling away from the living God, lest any one of you be hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. In Hebrews chapter 4 and verse 2, we learn that when we preach the truth concerning Jesus and what you and I must do to benefit from what he did, we are preaching good tidings. Now in Hebrews chapter 4 and verse 2, it is stressed that hearing does no good unless it is accompanied by faith. Faith cometh of hearing. The purpose of the preaching, Romans 10, 13 to 17, is to produce faith. And hearing does no good unless it is accompanied by faith. And so in Hebrews 4 and 11, those who have heard the good tidings must give diligence to enter into that rest, that no man fall after the same example of disobedience, that is, the example of the nation of Israel and how they fell. So since Jesus made all of this possible, Hebrews 4:14, he is a great high priest. In Hebrews 4:15, he is the priest who can sympathize. He is the priest who has compassion. He can be touched. That idea carries with it the idea of compassion, of sympathy. He can have sympathy toward us. And so in Hebrews 4:16, it is on the basis of one's relationship with Jesus, the high priest, who offered for man, that we may draw near with boldness to the throne of grace. Do you realize that it was through the working of the high priest on the Day of Atonement that the children of Israel could draw near to the tabernacle and to the temple with boldness, that they were in fellowship with God? If the high priest did not work on the Day of Atonement, there's a sin barrier out there that will not allow them to draw near with boldness to the temple or first to the tabernacle. Then in Hebrews 5, 1-3, Jesus is the only high priest who ever lived who did not have to offer gifts and sacrifices for his own sins. Every other man that's ever lived has sinned. And in order to be in fellowship with God, he's going to have to offer gifts for his own sins. But Jesus didn't have to do that. And because he did not have to do that, he became unto all them that obey him, chapter 5, verses 8 and 9, the author of eternal salvation. And now you get to where Tom was this morning in Hebrews 5, 11 and 14. As a result of my bringing myself into obedience to the plan provided by Jesus, I am able to grow in my Christian life to the point that I can become a full-grown man. I can't do that apart from the work of my high priest. And so in Hebrews 6, verses 1-8, I must then take heed to myself that I not fall away from this relationship which I have with the Christ. Because if I do that, I bring myself back under sin, and for the sin under which I bring myself now, there is no atonement. You see, Jesus has entered into the veil representing the Holy of Holies of the tabernacle and the temple. As, now look at this, a high priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. Why? To offer for the sins of the people. And when I obey the gospel, I'm cleansed by that offering. And if I remain in fellowship with God, 1 John 1, 7, that offering keeps me clean. And then in chapter 7, Jesus is a high priest of God's making. Who came up with this high priest idea anyway? Who laid down the criteria? Who said this is what must be met in order for one to be a high priest? It was God. And God made Jesus a high priest. He is not of the proper tribe to be a high priest under the Mosaic economy. Hebrews 7, 11-19. But he has been pronounced a priest forever, in order that he might be the surety of a better covenant. Now that's why in Hebrews 7 and verse 25, he is able to save to the uttermost them that draw nigh or near unto God. Now look at this, dia, through him. I can't approach God in and of myself. I'm a sinner. I'm separated when I'm in sin. But through my relationship with Christ, I'm able to draw near unto God. Now, why could Jesus do this? Well, in chapter 7, verses 26 and 27, you get the qualifications of the high priest who entered in for us. Notice, he is holy. He is guileless. He is undefiled. He is separated from sinners. He's made higher than the heavens. And then, who needeth not daily, like those high priests, to offer up sacrifices first for his own sins and then for the sins of the people. For this he did once, and the idea there is once for all time, when he offered up himself. Chapter 8, verses 1 and 2, he is the high priest who sat down on the right hand of the throne of majesty in the heavens, a minister of the sanctuary and of the true tabernacle. Now notice this, which the Lord pitched, not man. In chapter 9, verses 11 and 12, having come a high priest of the good things to come through the greater and more perfect tabernacle, not made with hands, through his own blood entered in once for all into the holy place, having obtained eternal redemption. Remember, the Lamb had to be without blemish. Chapter 9, verses 14 and 15, Jesus offered himself without blemish unto God. And for this cause, he is the mediator of a new covenant. that a death having taken place for the redemption of the transgressions that were under the first covenant, that they that have been called may receive the promise of the eternal inheritance. And then in verses 24 to 26 of chapter 9, for Christ entered not into the holy place made with hands, like in pattern to the true. Now notice this. But into heaven itself. Now to appear before the face of God, if you mark in your Bible, for us. Nor yet that he should offer himself often. As the high priest entereth in the holy place year by year with blood not his own, else must he often have suffered since the foundation of the world. But now notice this. But now once, at the end of the ages, hath he been manifested to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself. I want you to think with me about something. We hear a lot, or some at least, of this mistaken idea that sins were rolled forward every year under the old economy. And the implication of that was that they were held against the folks every year. Well, we began this study in Leviticus chapter 16 on the Day of Atonement and in verse 21. And I want you to notice something of what takes place on the Day of Atonement. Aaron is to go in and he is to offer for himself and the priests, and then he goes in and he offers for the people. And then they go out to Azazel. And notice again in verse 21, Aaron shall lay both his hands upon the head of the live goat and confess over him, A-L-L. Now how many escape all? Lay upon him all the iniquities of the children of Israel. And A-L-L, all their transgressions, even A-L-L, all their sins. And he shall put them upon the head of the goat, and shall send him away by the hand of a man that is in readiness into the wilderness, and the goat shall bear upon him A-L-L, all their iniquities unto a solitary land, and he shall let the goat go in the wilderness. If you're going to roll any sins forward, you better catch that goat. Because all those sins are on that goat. If that's not atonement, if that's not forgiveness, if that Hebrew couldn't go to bed at night knowing if I die, I'm in covenant relationship with God and go to heaven, then what was the use of all of this? Why spill all that blood? What kind of confidence did he have? Forgiveness takes place in the mind of God. God had set forth the scheme of redemption. God knew the surety of the sacrifice of Jesus. And based on that surety, as far as that Israelite or the others who brought themselves in the covenant relationship with God were concerned, they were forgiven. But every year, remembrance was made of sin. Why? Well, when you get to heaven, you ask, and God will explain it. But something occurred to me. You know, Aaron went into the Holy of Holies, didn't he? Every year, two times. But he always came out, didn't he? Because he had to keep on working. He had to keep on being in relationship with that nation in order that they might stay in fellowship with God. And there was a continual work for him. The Hebrews writer said that Jesus entered into the Holy of Holies once for all. But he didn't come out. When Jesus comes out, it won't be as high priest. It will be as judge. Jesus was able to accomplish in the once for all time entering in as our high priest what Aaron and his descendants could not accomplish because they were not qualified to remain in the Holy of Holies. But Jesus, when he ascended and offered up himself as our sin offering, sat down at the right hand of God in heaven. That's the continuing ability of the blood that was shed on Calvary. I'm thankful for that.
Amen.
I'm thankful I live under that covenant. But does that mean I don't remember sin? As often as you eat this bread and drink this cup, ye do show forth my death. Not death, burial, resurrection, ascension. My death. What's the significance of remembering the death of Jesus every Sunday? It's to remind me my high priest didn't come out. And if I do what the Hebrews were trying to do, if I leave that covenant and try to go back under a covenant that offers salvation through inadequate sacrifices, there remaineth no more a sacrifice for sin. Now that's the point the Hebrews writer was trying to get across to those folks. If you leave Christianity and go back to Judaism, to what are you going? It no longer has a sacrifice. So you can circumcise every Gentile in the world and try to make them a full proselyte, but it has no efficacy because there's no sacrifice. And without sacrifice, there's no avenue of atonement. And without an avenue of atonement, you're left in your sin. So what are you going back for? To attain, to accomplish, if you leave Christianity, go back into Judaism. In chapter 10, verse 3, it is impossible that the blood of bulls and goats should take away sin. But Jesus offered His blood to take away sins. I need to know that I have been sanctified, verse 10, through the offering of the body of Jesus Christ once for all. And in Hebrews chapter 10, the Hebrews writer says, because of that, there are three things you need to do. Verse 22. Let us draw near with a true heart in fullness of faith. Wish I had time to preach my little aside on the God who gives leftovers. God doesn't give snacks. God said to Malachi, get these folks to open up their storehouses and I'll pour grain out the windows. God said to Israel, when you get to the land flowing with milk and honey, I'll satiate you. You be faithful to me and you'll be satiated. You won't be hungry. When Jesus fed 5,000 and 4,000, they took up leftovers. Notice, draw near in fullness. When we grasp the concept of the God who gives leftovers, you tell me how we can come on the first day of the week with the attitude, let's hurry up and get this thing over with. We have more important things to do. Can you imagine Abraham and Isaac coming down off of one of those mountains in Moriah and looking over at one another after that mountaintop service and saying, I didn't get a thing in the world out of that today, did you? Can you imagine that? And yet I can come and sit in an assembly where I remember His death as my sin offering. And write notes and talk and be concerned with everything under the sun and make faces at the youngins and have the idea, let's hurry up and get this thing over with. I have things I want to do. You tell me we have caught a glimpse of atonement when that's our attitude. I don't believe it for a minute. Why did Israel go into Assyrian captivity in 722 B.C.? Why did Judah go into Babylonian captivity in 586 B.C. because they didn't have a clue about atonement. Now you say, prove it. Isaiah chapter 1. Take your sacrifices and go home, God said. When you go learn how to live, then you come off your sacrifices. Now, ladies and gentlemen, atonement affects not what we do, but what we are. And when you go back to Genesis chapter 4, and there are two boys out there at those altars, before God ever accepted Abel's offering, the text says he accepted Abel. That's a lifestyle. Before God ever rejected Cain's offering, the text says he rejected Cain. That's a lifestyle. And 1 John 3:12 makes it clear. Why did he slay him? Because his works were evil. That's a lifestyle. His worship was an outgrowth of what he was. And when I go away from that memorial feast saying, let's hurry up and get this over with, that is a commentary on what I am, not what I'm doing. And I don't have a clue as to what atonement means. And I'm going to tell you something. When I know what atonement means, I don't have to sway to get close to God. When I know what atonement means, I don't have to clap after somebody's told me about my God. When I know what atonement means, I don't have to have some type of zip-zap service to get me excited about the service of God. Now, you want to know what's wrong with the model paradigm churches among us? They don't have a clue about atonement. That's the problem. And they will grasp every straw under the sun to make it exciting, to keep interest. God doesn't work like man works. My ways are not your ways. My thoughts are not your thoughts. As the heavens are high above the earth, so are my thoughts than your thoughts and my ways than your ways. God doesn't work on this entertainment level business. The only thing God offers me to get me excited about Christianity is a sin offering on a cross on a hill outside Jerusalem. That's all God has to excite me about Christianity. And when I'm looking for zip-zap entertainment, I'm looking at the wrong God. My God offers atonement, not entertainment. And those things are high and far apart. Number two, verse 23. Let us hold fast the confession of our hope, that it waver not. You know what hold fast means? If you don't know what hold fast means, climb Clingman's Dome and fall off and catch a branch. And you'll understand hold fast. Hold on. I preached his funeral several years ago. I see him now. He was our song leader when I was a boy. He didn't know one note of music. But I can hear him now. Hold to God's unchanging hand. Hold fast our hope. And then number three, verse 24. Let us consider one another to provoke unto love and good works. And I know you've preached the let us verses in the book of Hebrews. But notice these motivations all based on the high priesthood of Jesus and what he did for us so that we could receive this idea of atonement. And then in Hebrews chapter 10 and verse 34, we must not cast away the better possession, but rather press on even to the point of enduring persecution. Hebrews 10:32 through chapter 11 and verse 40. And the real temptation is just preach on chapter 11, isn't it? But I discovered several years ago, it doesn't start at chapter 11, verse 1. This fellow, what's his name? Stevens, that was riding horseback and divided the New Testament into chapters and verses. One thing of which you will become acutely aware as you read the New Testament is that horse stepped in a lot of holes. And every time it hit a hole, he made a chapter division. And a lot of them ought not have been there. You have to go way back to about chapter 9 to get the start of where you're going to end up in chapter 12. And put that thing together based on the atonement that is provided through Jesus. And then in chapter 12, verses 1 and 2, he draws a conclusion that everything that God had laid out in the scheme of redemption could be accomplished for us when we are looking unto Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross. He didn't enjoy it. Bitter pain and tears and sweat. But he endured the cross, having despised or despising shame. And Galatians talks about the shame of one hanged on a tree. And hath sat down. That's what he did when he ascended. When he was accepted as our atonement, as our sin offering, he sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. He entered into that Holy of Holies once for all. In chapter 12 and verse 24, the powerful nature of the blood of Jesus is seen in it, the fact that he is a mediator of a new covenant. And he offered the blood of sprinkling that speaketh better than that of Abel. And then in chapter 13, 20 and 21, Jesus, that he might sanctify the people, suffered without the gate. And the writer concluded the benediction to remind me that I am perfected. That's where Tom was this morning. With the blood of an eternal covenant. There was not a single drop of blood shed in the Old Testament relative to sin that didn't look toward Jesus. And what Jesus accomplished flowed all the way back to all those folks under patriarchy and Mosaic and forward to the end of this world. He's my substitute. He expiated. He took care of those three Hebrew ideas of sin and that Greek idea of sin. Missing the mark, but more. And then miss the way and rebel and transgress. Thanks be to God for His unspeakable gift. And thank you for listening.